From Washington, this is VOA's International Edition. Coming up, another possible hitch in the Ukraine ceasefire. What motivates extremist groups like the Islamic State?
They're not thinking rationally. They're thinking in a very apocalyptic, end of times kind of way.
VOA's Meredith Buell has that story, and it appears that relations between Pakistan and Afghanistan are changing, and China is involved. It's all ahead. Stay with us. I'm Ira Melman. Well, Ukrainian President Petro Poroshenko says his military is ready to return its heavy weapons to the front lines in eastern Ukraine, noting that Russian-backed rebels are still violating a ceasefire deal reached earlier this month. Mr. Poroshenko said Friday Ukraine's army is ready at any moment to stand up to the enemy. He also said a military threat from the east will remain even if the truce holds, an obvious reference to Russia. Russia's foreign minister, Sergei Lavrov, said Friday there's been progress in the withdrawal of heavy weapons in eastern Ukraine. He stressed the importance of fulfilling other aspects of the truce, including key humanitarian issues and constitutional reform in the Donbas region of eastern Ukraine. Thursday, Ukrainian troops began withdrawing artillery from a frontline eastern village near the devastated town of Debaltseve under the watchful eye of European monitors overseeing the ceasefire deal. Military officials on Thursday showed reporters from the Reuters news agency trucks towing 100-millimeter guns from the village as Ukraine acknowledged a marked reduction in rebel attacks over the past few days. Media reports say the masked Islamic State militant who appeared in several videos of hostage beheadings has been tentatively identified, but security sources caution reports may not be accurate. Reports are quoting friends of Mohammed Amwazi as saying they believe he is the tall, London-accented speaker dubbed Jihadi John. Two U.S. government sources told Reuters news agency that investigators believe Amwazi is the masked man. However, VOA's Jamie Detmer, our reporter in Rome, says European intelligence sources refuse to confirm the identification, saying the story is more complicated than that. The U.S. National Security Council spokeswoman says the murder of U.S. citizens by the Islamic State continues to be investigated, but would not confirm or deny the reports about the identity of Jihadi John. She says U.S. authorities are working closely with international partners, including Britain, to bring the murderers to justice. Well, what motivates the leadership of the Islamic State terrorist group, which continues to commit atrocities in the Middle East and North Africa and appears to have global ambitions? Some regional analysts say their interpretation of the Quran, combined with the belief that the end of the world is coming soon, shapes the group's strategy and barbaric behavior. VOA correspondent Meredith Buell has more.
The Islamic State continues to shock the world, whether it is the beheading of Egyptian Christians, burning to death a Jordanian pilot, or turning Yazidi women into slaves. These Islamic radicals appear to have no boundaries. Instead, they are publishing videos glorifying violence. Analysts say the militants are operating based on an understanding of the Quran and prophecies from the 7th century. Peter Bergen is a national security analyst for CNN and vice president of the nonprofit New America Foundation. He says IS leaders are true believers in an interpretation of the Quran that seeks war.
I mean, rationally, you wouldn't want to bring the United States in a war against you, 60 other countries, the entire Arab world, Jordan and Egypt, etc. But they're not thinking rationally. They're thinking in a very apocalyptic, end of times kind of way.
Bergen says IS leaders believe the world will come to an end soon, with the final battle taking place in a town in northern Syria. The prophecy is romanticized by IS recruiters, since in the final battle, those they consider crusaders and infidels will be defeated by Islamic warriors. Many analysts say the militant group wants Western military forces to invade Syria and confirm the prediction. Professor John Horgan is director of the Center for Terrorism and Security Studies at the University of Massachusetts in Lowell.
Islamic State certainly wants us to believe them when they say this is about religion, this is about a civilizational clash that is going to draw to an inevitable confrontation, and that is certainly part of their strategy.
Some regional experts say IS leaders are certain they represent the front line of a religious, even cosmic war between good and evil. Analysts like Peter Bergen say numerous Islamic clerics have condemned IS, and more voices are needed.
They really do believe in a sort of Salafist militant view of the world, and the only real response to that is an ideological response, and the only people who are most equipped to do that are Muslim leaders and scholars who can really argue the case that this is an aberration in Islam.
Other analysts say that many of the foreign fighters joining the militants are unsuccessful at home and are seeking adventure in an overseas war. They say while some are hardened jihadists, they are not as likely as the leadership to be motivated by religion. Again, Professor John Horgan.
The thrill of adventure, the excitement and the comfort you get from camaraderie, I mean, those are very, very powerful motivating factors. And those are the kinds of things that the Islamic State has been very adept at communicating via social media.
Regional analysts say the way to defeat IS is to wipe out its leadership and take back the territory it has captured. U.S. officials say 30% of the land the group has gained in Iraq has now been returned to Iraqis. As its self-proclaimed caliphate shrinks, analysts say its claim to being an agent of the apocalypse will deteriorate. Meredith Buell, VOA News, Washington.
On Wednesday, federal agents announced the arrest of three young men whom they allege were recruited by the Islamic State. The terrorist group is well known for its canny use of social media to spread its message and gain sympathizers and recruits. For this report, VOA's Adam Phillips spoke with an expert about the Islamic State's online propaganda videos, which feature music and poetry based on classical religious traditions.
Princeton University Near Eastern Studies professor Bernard Haeckel, a leading expert on jihadi culture, sits before his laptop computer screen and watches yet another high-end Islamic State video. This one features a dashing young Islamic State recruit standing near a stack of captured weaponry somewhere in Syria and speechifying in preparation for a poem written in the classical style.
Here's the poetry.
It was composed by him, presumably, or someone close to him, obviously memorized because he's reciting it as if it were extemporaneous. And it is in classical Arabic in its language, its meter, and its imagery.
Much of the imagery has to do with a galloping expansion of Islam in its early days, when the Prophet Muhammad and his immediate successors in Arabia conquered territory from Iran to Spain. Many of those lands, such as Syria and Egypt, which had been Christian until the conquest, remain Muslim to this day.
What he's saying is that we're trying to revive the early community and the spirit of that early community, which was powerful and warlike and had pride and was not humiliated and broken and defeated like it has become.
The VOA asked Haeckel why the Islamic State even bothers to write such poetry and post it online. Wouldn't it suffice simply to wage war effectively?
Well, they're trying to justify their cause and the righteousness of their cause. They are also trying to get recruits to join them. And they're also appealing to the wider world of Muslims who see them as extremists and who don't identify them with the Islam that they know and believe. And they're trying to say, no, we're the real thing.
To help lure young men to their cause, videos produced by the Islamic State and their sympathizers often use dramatic visuals culled from video war games. Some show Muslim heroes raising triumphant swords over smoldering cities.
So there's a lot about the martial culture of medieval times and men on horseback.
Islamist propaganda videos are not new. Haeckel says that Al-Qaeda also used them. But videos produced by the Islamic State are better attuned to global youth culture.
They don't have these like hour-long droning speeches by leaders. They typically use much more punchy and catchy, much shorter videos.
If there is such a thing as an Islamic State anthem, it is My Ummah, Dawn Has Appeared, a traditional song called Nasheed, sung a cappella, because musical instruments are forbidden in the ancient form of Islam practiced by the Islamic State. My Ummah, Dawn Has Appeared, the words say, so await the expected victory. The Islamic State has arisen by the blood of the righteous. One popular form of the video includes sound effects of marching feet and a sword being unsheathed. Haeckel says the Islamic State uses martial music to glorify the past and justify violence, much the way the Nazis once did, with this difference.
I'm not sure it's a fascistic culture because it's not modeled around a particular individual, like when Hitler kind of embodied the spirit of the German people. I mean, this is more a religious culture that is not exclusivist in the sense of being racially exclusivist or ethnically exclusivist. All Muslims are supposed to belong to this culture. Of course, most Muslims don't agree with them, and I should underscore that.
Indeed, anyone who resists the Islamic State or its tactics is judged to be an infidel, an unbeliever, and as such, an enemy of both jihad and Allah, or God.
Not just, you know, Jews and Christians and non-Muslims, but also Muslims who don't agree with them, or people who don't adhere to true Islam as they define it, as ISIS defines it. So most of their victims are Muslim.
Haeckel adds that certain kinds of Islamic State propaganda is aimed at governments, both in the Middle East and the West, who oppose their conquest.
Beheadings and the burning people alive and that sort of thing, that's intended to terrorize the enemy by telling them, look, if you fight us and we capture you, this is what will happen to you. They argue that if you terrorize the enemy in that way, the Muslim State will win much more quickly and readily.
The Obama administration has expanded its efforts to counter Islamic State propaganda with its own social media campaign, featuring Muslim clerics and others denouncing the Islamic State and its tactics. However, Bernard Haeckel of Princeton University says the war of information among Muslims must be waged by Muslims who are not perceived as being mouthpieces for the West. Adam Phillips, VOA News, New York.
This is International Edition from the Voice of America. I'm Ira Melman. For decades, relations between Pakistan and Afghanistan have been marred by mutual mistrust and suspicion. However, there's a new administration in place in Kabul, and there's new outreach by Pakistan's military chief. So there are signs of major changes for the long wary neighbors. More from Islamabad and Ayaz Ghul.
Last November, when Afghan President Ashraf Ghani visited Pakistan, his first stop was the headquarters of the country's powerful military, an institution Afghans blamed for the troubles facing their country. Since that initial outreach, Pakistan Army Chief Rahil Sharif has undertaken several trips to Kabul along with Pakistan's intelligence chief and other commanders to deepen relations with their Afghan counterparts. That top officials are regularly meeting is unprecedented after years in which each country blamed the other for violent attacks on its soil. But the new cooperation goes beyond these top-level visits. Pakistani authorities say there is now better military and intelligence cooperation, with Afghanistan launching counter-terrorism actions against fugitive Pakistani militants on its soil. Afghan officials also have acknowledged Pakistani counter-terrorism measures are improving security along their border. Recently, a small group of Afghan army cadets for the first time joined Pakistan's prestigious military academy in Abbottabad. In Pakistan, civilian and military leaders appear to be focused on convincing local and foreign critics that Islamabad is abandoning its past interventionist policy in Afghanistan. Army spokesman Major General Asim Bajwa tells VOA that the officials are focused on the deep ties that have long bound the nations together despite their history of animosity.
If you see the overall context, Pakistanis and Afghans are brothers. There has been a bad patch, no doubt about this. But then I think we are restoring our relationship to normalcy. And there are cadets who are coming to Pakistan. You go and meet a common Afghan on the streets, he must have been in Pakistan. So it's like homecoming for all Afghans, and we really cherish to visit Kabul.
Former Pakistani ambassador to Afghanistan, Muhammad Sadiq, is the secretary of Pakistan's recently established National Security Division. During a seminar in Islamabad, he tried to explain the reasons behind the unexpected thaw in Pakistan-Afghanistan relations.
President Karzai was very suspicious of Pakistan, and we were very suspicious of President Karzai at the same time. So there were a lot of agreements, but they were never implemented. Luckily, Ashraf Ghani was practically present in all those meetings as ministers first and then as advisor to President Karzai. Now the implementation of those agreement is happening after the unity government. And because of that, you know, new venues of cooperation are opening.
Sadiq said the two countries' military and security agencies are the parts of the government that have harbored the deepest mistrust. But there are efforts on both sides to address the issue and move forward.
The complaints are against sections of the government. For example, we have complaints about Afghan intelligence. We have a complaint about Afghan border police. Pakistan have complaints about their Ministry for Frontier and Tribal Affairs. You know, roughly these three. The Afghan government has complained against Pakistan Army and against ISI. So two departments of the government. Our position from the beginning was we have to bring these two together, let them sit together and sort it out and find solutions. That is happening now.
Afghan leaders also have acknowledged the time has come for joint efforts to neutralize the threat of extremism and terrorism. Afghanistan's ambassador to Pakistan, Janan Musazai, says his country has initiated the hard but necessary work to build trust, confidence and cooperation with Pakistan with a clear focus on promoting regional peace and security. He also emphasized the need for media and Islamic scholars in both countries to work against religious extremists on both sides.
If this is a common fight, which we have absolutely no doubt it is, the fight against terrorism and extremism and for peace and security, then we must also forge that necessary common narrative to ensure its success. I believe we need to call out those individuals, whoever they might be, in both countries, who are calling for jihad in either of our two countries, or who refer to the violence, the terrorism that's occurring in both countries as jihad.
The close cooperation between the security establishments of the two countries has raised hopes for opening peace talks between the Afghan government and the Taliban. It is widely believed that key leaders of the insurgent group are sheltering in Pakistan, and Kabul believes Pakistan's spy agency can coerce the Taliban to the negotiating table. However, there are also signs that China could play an influential role as a peace broker because of Beijing's traditional strong ties to Pakistan and the goodwill it enjoys among Afghans, says author Ahmad Rashid.
China has the respect of all the major stakeholders, Pakistan, Iran, and Afghanistan. It also has the respect of the Taliban. So we have a country now that for the first time is going to be playing an international mediating role outside its borders. So China is taking a first step into the international arena of mediation over Afghanistan.
Some observers say Chinese officials also are pushing Pakistan to ease tensions with neighboring India. China has long sought investment opportunities in the region, motivating Beijing to push for peace in Afghanistan for regional stability and commerce. Ayaz Gul for VOA News, Islamabad.
The South Korean government is considering the establishment of a cash-for-prisoner exchange program with North Korea. VOA's Brian Patton says that most of the people Seoul wants to free are prisoners of war who have been held by the North since 1953.
Lee Won-koo, who was recently appointed South Korea's prime minister, told Parliament this week he wants to bring home prisoners of war who have been held in the North for more than 60 years, as well as other South Koreans who have been abducted by Pyongyang. One way to possibly do this, he says, is to pay Pyongyang the same way West Germany paid East Germany during the Cold War to free thousands of prisoners under a program called Freikorps.
예, 기본적으로 말씀드린 대로 한국형
He says a Korean-style Freikorps is worth considering, and he will direct the government to conduct a more in-depth study on the issue. The South Korean government believes that more than 500 POWs who were captured by the North prior to the end of the Korean War in 1953 are still being held today. Since hostilities ended, North Korea is believed to have arrested or abducted hundreds more citizens from the South for a variety of reasons. Choi Sung-young says North Korean agents kidnapped his father, who was working in a fishery near the border in 1967. Choi is now the president of a group called the Representative of the Abductees Family Union. Choi says North Korea took his father because he was a well-known South Korean Navy captain during the war.
북한 애들이 아버님을 그 공개 재판에 회부를
He says North Korea brought his father to an open trial and executed him. His father, he says, was later the first abductee to be awarded a medal from the Park Geun-hye government. The South Korean Unification Ministry first floated the idea of paying for the release of POWs and political prisoners a few years back.
That's Brian Padden reporting from Seoul. Thanks so much for joining us today on International Edition. Get the latest breaking news and analysis on global events 24 hours a day at our website at voanews.com. I'm Ira Melman in Washington. Have a great day.
This is Today in History. On February 27, 1900, the British Labour Party was founded. It became the largest centre-left political party in the United Kingdom. In 1922, then Commerce Secretary Herbert Hoover convened the first national radio conference. The conference called for the federal control of broadcasting in the U.S. In 1933, Germany's parliament building, the Reichstag, burned. The Nazis blamed the communists and used the fire as a pretext for suspending civil liberties and increasing their power. On this day in 1972, U.S. President Richard Nixon, at the conclusion of an historic visit to China, joined Chinese Premier Zhou Enlai in signing the so-called Shanghai Communique. The document opened the way for normalized relations, achieved 7 years later. I'm Dave DeForest with VOA's Today in History.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
It's no surprise that working through the vast and complex issues surrounding Iran's nuclear program would take time, especially given the trust deficit between the world and Iran, said President Barack Obama at a news conference in Washington with German Chancellor Angela Merkel. But since the interim accord, known as the Joint Plan of Action, was agreed to by the negotiating parties, the EU, the P5 plus one countries, and Iran, in November 2013, the time has been well spent, Mr. Obama said. Serious issues have been discussed and clarified, and gaps between the two sides have been narrowed. Iran has abided by the agreement, which has not only frozen their nuclear program, but, as in the case of its supply of 20% enriched uranium, reversed key elements. Now the negotiations are at the point where the Iranians need to make a decision, said President Obama.
We are presenting to them, in a unified fashion, the P5 plus one, supported by a coalition of countries around the world, are presenting to them a deal that allows them to have peaceful nuclear power, but gives us the absolute assurance that is verifiable that they are not pursuing a nuclear weapon.
Mr. Obama said he did not see a need for an extension of the nuclear negotiations. The parties have agreed to the goal of reaching a framework for a comprehensive agreement by the end of March and completing the comprehensive agreement by the end of June.
I don't see a further extension being useful if they have not agreed to the basic formulation and the bottom line that the world requires to have confidence that they're not pursuing a nuclear weapon. Now, if the framework for a deal is done, if people have a clear sense of what is required, and there's some drafting and T's to cross and I's to dot, that's a different issue.
President Obama noted the key question at this time is, does Iran have the political will and desire to get a deal done? They should be able, he said, to get to yes.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. For a transcript of this and other VOA editorials, or to receive editorials by email, visit the VOA Editorials Internet homepage at www.voanews.com/editorials.
Langsung dari Washington.